and he was accusing me of wanting to take my mom away from him, and also accusing me of snooping through his things, which I didn't. But because he said that, it made me question, what is he trying to hide?
I'm sitting in the office of a man who prosecutes murders for a living. His name is Matt Murphy. He's a veteran assistant district attorney who handles homicides out of Newport Beach, California. The homicide case that landed on his desk in the summer of 2016 was particularly violent, and it was unique in his experience.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Lisa Zambetti, casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my beloved colleague. And today we are missing our beloved Laura Richards, who is in London, and it's about 3 in the morning where she is right now, so she'll be back with us next time.
Yes. But we do have a very special return guest in the studio, and that is...
Chris Gofford, Los Angeles Times.
How you doing, Chris?
Great to be here, thanks.
Great. And how long have you been with the Los Angeles Times?
10 years. 10 years before that, I was at the Daily Pilot and the St. Petersburg Times in Florida.
Can you just tell us why you got into investigative reporting?
I like telling people stories, and my specialty now is long-form narratives. Last year, I did a 6-part series called Framed, about a bizarre case out of Irvine. And I tend to spend 6-7 months on a story, doing hundreds of hours of reporting, and this one I think is stranger and more compelling than any of the previous stuff I've done.
Right, and of course we're talking about Dirty John.
That's right. Before we go on, where did you go to journalism school? It was on the East Coast, right?
I didn't go to journalism school. Oh. I got an English degree from Cornell.
But I'm really glad you did become a journalist, because this Dirty John series is amazing, and we have so much to talk about. We've already covered episodes 1 through 3 last time, and so if you don't want to be spoiled for the rest of the series, 4, 5, and 6, then please go listen to them now, because we are going to talk about them in depth.
Yeah. So how does it feel being a podcaster on top of being a reporter for the Los Angeles Times?
It's a lot of fun, but it's been a challenge. Trying to learn to write in a way that is easy on the ear. I tend to like longer sentences with a lot of dashes and a lot of commas, and I'm learning to fix that.
Do you like your voice?
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. You know, sometimes it makes me want to run out of the room when I hear it, and sometimes it's okay.
Well, unlike me, you have a great face for TV, and you shouldn't just be relegated to the radio and the podcast arena.
So. Well, I've been a print guy for 20 years, so this is all new to me, and I'm excited to see how people are going to react to the podcast.
Cool. Well, we're very, very happy to be part of it, and, mm-hmm. and in partnership with Wondery. This is such an exciting project. And so let's launch right back into episode 4 of Dirty John.
So episode 4 is called Forgiveness. So where are we at when we get to episode 4? You want to catch us up here?
Episode 4, John Meehan is managing to convince Deborah Newell, his wife, that despite the long history of restraining orders against him, his history of crime in Ohio and in Michigan and in California, that he really is a good guy, and that a lot of these accusations against him are false. He's been wrongly accused, and he is so manipulative and so persuasive that he manages to talk his way back into Deborah's life.
Yeah.
Against her better judgment and against the clamor of her family.
Yeah, and I think I want to comment about that. I think one of the things we talked about earlier was the fact that because Deborah had such a poor self-image, and because John actually elevated that image significantly, because he made her feel great about herself. That was an incredibly important thing to her, so she would look away about the other things. The other thing we talked about was, why was he so rude to family members right out of the gate? Maybe not her mother, because maybe He felt like her mother was very important to her, and she would not disregard her mother, but her children kind of can go off and live their own life. But why would he be so antagonistic against the daughters,
for example? Your theory is that he did it deliberately as a means of isolating her.
Absolutely.
It's a very interesting theory, and I can't really argue with it.
Well, I mean, I think it bears itself out in this, because what happens when she actually forgives John and brings him back into her life? What happens with her family?
The family is so aghast at this that they start pulling away from her. Some of them won't let their grandkids around her anymore because John's going to be there.
Right. And even in the instances where he's not supposed to be there, he kind of shows up and he kind of has presents and he gives them to the kids and he becomes the center of attention to the kids.
Yeah, that's early on. That's in the first few months at the Christmas gathering at the very beginning.
Right, so they don't want that to happen again. So they actually pull their whole family and their whole lives away from Deborah. What does that mean? It means John has won. John gets her isolated. John has complete control of her now. John, just by saying the right things and doing little things for her, can actually have her all to himself.
But it's a short-sighted game.
Well, obviously, he's not planning the long run here, like most psychopaths, and obviously he's not clinically diagnosed as that, but in an indirect personality assessment, I would put him very high on that psychopathy scale.
What's interesting about episode 4, though, Christopher, is that you really do a deep dive into the psychology of Deborah's family, you know, her sister and her mother, which, you know, Jim always says that human behavior is so complicated. So, you know, John, from what you've reported, John probably couldn't have gone so far down this road with her if not for her background and the story that you tell about her sister. So,
yeah, what happened is Deborah had an older sister named Cindy, mm-hmm. Cindy Vickers. And she'd been married, I think, 13 years to a husband named Billy Vickers. Mm. And they were fighting. They were estranged. And one day he walked up behind her. She was in the house that they had just sold in Garden Grove. He walks up behind her while she's writing out checks with a gun that he's taken from a friend. And he shoots her in the back of the head, kills her with a single shot, and then shoots himself. He survives. And he goes to trial, charged with murder. The jury deadlocks, and he ultimately pleads guilty to voluntary manslaughter and serves less than 3 years. Now, one of the things that influenced the jury was the testimony of Arlene, who is the mother both of Deborah and of Cindy. And Arlene said, I hate what Billy's done, but I love Billy. And I forgive Billy. Mm. And so I talked to the prosecutor who handled this case back in 1985. He's still in Orange County. And he said it was the most astonishing thing he can remember. You don't see that from the mother of the victim herself very often.
Can I ask you a question? Was the mother a Christian?
Oh, yeah. There is a very strong religious element in this family.
So the fact that she was a Christian, and a good Christian, she believed in forgiveness, right? So she believed she was doing the right thing by forgiving him, despite the fact that maybe somebody might take advantage of that.
The idea is that if God can forgive humanity for killing his only son, then we can forgive those who have wronged us. I mean, that's basically the idea that that Deborah Newell grew up around. She herself was never able to forgive in the way her mom did the killer of her sister, but she absorbed a lot of that way of thinking.
So does that make you feel a little bit different about Deborah and her behavior with respect to John?
Well, what it makes me I really wish Laura was here because this is so her wheelhouse. So what you describe in your reporting of what Cindy is going through is such classic coercive control. I mean, the way you lay it out, how he controls every aspect of her financially. You know,
there. You mean Deborah and John? Deborah?
No,
John. Cindy's.
Yes,
the sister.
I know that.
Cindy went through first.
Yes,
yeah.
It was Cindy and Bobby. Is that his name?
Billy.
What you described, though, the relationship that I read in that episode was of a couple that we always talk about. How the man is, you know, controlling the woman in a very different way than Deborah's relationship is with Dirty John, you know. And I hate to say this, but I hate Billy way more than I hate Dirty John, because he did do what Laura is always warning about, is when the wife is getting ready to leave, that's the most dangerous time, and he acted upon it. And I don't know where I'm going with this, but that was...
Well, we'll see, because I think what John actually does is pretty goddamn dirty. And he did something...
I mean, at this point in the story. Okay,
right,
at this
point
in the story.
At this
point
in the story, right.
But I think what Laura would say is people don't recognize that course of control. They don't recognize...
That it's a crime.
That it's a crime, and that's abuse. And that she may love Billy and think that he's great and they should stay together, but her daughter needed support in getting out of that relationship. That's what... If Laura was here, I'm sure she would say that.
Absolutely. But in this particular case with Deborah and John, you have to understand that this is a form of coercive control. She is a victim of that control because her vulnerability is her poor self-image. Her vulnerability is her need to feel wanted, her need to be with someone else. And if he was satisfying those things, she sacrificed her family, her freedom, her money, and in the end, almost a lot more.
This is true.
And the other thing you say about when Arlene testifies on behalf of Billy is that she basically throws her own daughter under the bus. I mean...
Well, this is the prosecutor's interpretation. I looked for the transcript, which no longer exists, of the trial itself. They destroyed the court exhibits. And so there was very little about the trial itself I was able to piece together. So I don't have the mother's testimony. That was how the prosecutor, Thomas Avdeef is his name, interpreted Arlene's testimony. It worked against his case, for sure. Deborah has a different interpretation of it. She doesn't have a lot of detail that she recollects from the trial. This was 32 years ago now.
But it's interesting how Deborah may have taken on this sort of this burden of forgiveness because she couldn't forgive her sister's killer. She may have felt that it was her responsibility to forgive somebody in her life like that, and that was, of course, John.
It's possible. I asked Deborah, do you think that what happened with your sister and your background in a family where forgiveness is paramount, I think it influenced your decision to take John back? And she said she's not sure, so we'll have to make up our own our own minds about that. But it seems too vivid and strange a story to be in a family's background without influencing people in some way.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to be outside of the situation to actually understand and see what was going on from an objective point of view. And I don't think Deborah can be objective about this particular case. There's too many emotions tied in, and too much of her own self-worth is tied into how she reads her own behavior.
Even beyond his size, there was a single-minded viciousness about John, a sense that he'd stop at nothing. Shad decided to keep his distance.
Okay, so now we move on to episode 5.
Well, and this is when John really kicks in his aggressive offensive defense, right? They go to a lawyer, don't they?
John says, Deborah, give me a couple of weeks. I'm going to prove to you that I've been set up in case after case after case. And so he enlists this lawyer named John Jallo in Santa Ana. And Jallo recounted for me, you could hear it at the top of episode 5, what it was like sitting across from John and Deborah. John's agenda is He wants to file a flurry of legal actions against all of his enemies. He wants to sue the Laguna Beach police, claiming that they kept his money when they raided his place. He wants to sue the woman that he's gone to prison for extorting and stalking. He wants to sue another one of his victims for allegedly stealing some stuff from him. And he wants this done immediately. The lawyer, John Jahlo, is looking at Deborah Newell, sitting right next to John, and thinking, this woman is hopelessly in love with him, extremely vulnerable. She needs some help. And he suggests maybe a postnup would help smooth things over with her family. They might not believe that he's after her money if they could draft a postnup. And Jahlo describes John Meehan's complete transformation. He says that he could hear the seething cauldron within his brain. It was almost as if his brain was going to explode. He says, it's like the, you know, people talk about meeting holy personages, and it leaves an impression that lasts for years, you
right.
know? This was the opposite of that. It was like looking into darkness, and it
abyss?
Yes.
Yes.
It was, that was the impression this guy made, and, over and over, people who met this guy or dealt with this guy say, scariest guy I ever met, scariest criminal I hunted in 40 years of law enforcement, scariest client I ever represented, scariest man I ever had the fear of sitting across from.
Wow, or laying in bed with and marrying, right?
But that's so interesting that they're so scared of him, and we say this, you know, over and over, and yet we don't think he's actually ever physically hurt anybody. He's never actually, that we know of, abused his ex-wife or his kids or actually shot anybody, but he has this aura of evil around him.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, one of his sisters said John was basically a coward. He made a lot of threats, but he wasn't known to hurt people violently.
Well, can I ask you a question? When they went to this lawyer, they paid him a retainer. Was that John's money or Deborah's money?
I think it was probably on Deborah's credit card.
I think it probably was. And so they go out and they're going to aggressively file all these lawsuits against people that are in his past, people that he screwed over, right? So he's using a later love relationship to actually attack his past love relationships, people he'd already hurt and defrauded and stolen from. Right? I mean,
although the lawyer didn't see any grounds for filing any of these suits, and he told John this, and John became very aggressive with him and screamed and yelled and demanded the entire retainer back, and if he didn't get it back, he was going to go to the bar.
Okay. But do you think John got it back, or do you think Deborah got it back?
I think their funds might have been commingled at that point. I'm not sure.
Mm.
Good question.
Yeah.
Good question.
Well, I would bet anything that John got the use of that money and not Deborah. And didn't he, in the end, still file a complaint against this lawyer?
I think he filed a complaint against this lawyer in keeping with his pattern of...
Of being a psychopath?
You just got to stick it to him no matter what. I mean, you have to just...
Going to the extreme with anybody he perceived as an enemy.
Right.
And taking a real pleasure in ruining people's lives and careers.
Let me tell you something about sadistic people, okay? They actually derive even a sexual pleasure from causing and witnessing the suffering of others. Does that sound consistent with what John did?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so they actually derive a deep pleasure from not only doing it, but witnessing it. It's not enough to just cause somebody a problem, but they'd want to actually be a part of that. Like, and I think in some of the recordings that you played, he was relishing as he was saying these things, and the veiled threats that he made, and then going on to direct threats, he was relishing that people are hearing him say that, and even if they didn't know for certain, they had in the back of their minds, oh my God. What if he did follow through on this? What if this does happen? I think he was relishing the fact that they were suffering because of the words coming out of his mouth.
He did have a way of getting into people's nightmares.
Mm.
Well, finally, she decides it's time to get a divorce. What do you think was the final straw, the light bulb that really made her, after all of this deception, after all of this suspicion, she finally said, okay, I'm out.
I think she had this belief that in the fullness of time, her family would come around. She would have the man that she loved, and she'd have her kids around her again. She wanted this to work, and it occurred to her finally that it just wasn't going to happen. The daughter Jacqueline was taking real estate classes, and Deborah was helping to finance that. John found out and made some very nasty threats. He said he'd throw her in the ocean. She wouldn't come out. At one point, he sends a text to Jacqueline telling her to jump off a roof head first. And Deborah says to herself,
there's something wrong here?
This is not going to happen.
Finally, Lisa, you get your you get what you wanted, okay? She actually did stand up for herself. Maybe it was the threats to her daughter that actually did it. That when she realized it's not just about her, it's actually a threat to her child. Maybe that's what woke her up. He was sending her love poems. He was doing everything in his power to keep her on that hook. I mean, he had hooked her well, and he didn't want to let her off. But eventually, she did get off.
So now this poor lady is trying to get away from him. And, of course, he goes full-on psycho on her now. He's just, now it all is coming out. He does not hold back with his nasty emails and really showing his true colors.
But at the same time, he's playing on her emotions. He's saying he's dying of cancer. Right, he's saying that you have
how can
to.
How can you abandon your husband when he's dying of cancer?
Wait, I thought he had MS. Wait, make up your mind. You got MS,
yes,
cancer.
Yeah,
what is
MS
it?
MS and cancer.
I need you. Yeah. Oh, those are such important words. Such manipulative words. Did he really need her? No, but he needed her to think that he needed her, and he knew that would flip a switch in her mind. Like, oh, he wants my help. I can help him. He does love me. I am something. I am worth something. It's unfortunate, but he just knew. And psychopaths are really good at picking up vulnerabilities of other people and then playing upon them. It sounds like he read her from day one. You know, obviously, there's a lot of leakage in there, but he thought he would take the risks that he did. And in the end, he was definitely able to control her not only once, but twice, get her back after he'd lost her. Why? Because, again, that's another challenge. Why didn't he go after another woman? Because this was a greater challenge, because he had sort of screwed up and failed. He wanted to prove he could do it.
I don't know that he wasn't going after other women, because on his laptop, Deborah found all kinds of women, hundreds of them.
Well, it probably never stopped, right?
In fact, on their wedding day, he was going on dating sites, flirting with people.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. What a winner. I wish Laura was here, because I wanted you to talk about her failure to get a restraining order against him. There's this whole saga about they try and try and try, and despite all of these threats and all of this bad behavior, they're not able to do that. I mean, why?
Right. Well,
why?
Part of it is because of her behavior, unfortunately, because she thought she could talk him into it. She thought she could get him to reason, and she spent a night at the house with him, completely wiping out any indication that there was a threat from him. You can't get a restraining order because he
talks
to her.
Well, I don't know if it was with him. It was on the floor, she says. She went out there to talk him into an annulment, and
why does that mess up the restraining order? Like,
because
why?
The restraining order is only because there is a physical threat to you of harm you or your family.
They denied the restraining order before that. That was why they couldn't go back and get an amended complaint through a judge. But the restraining order itself that they applied for was rejected even before that incident on the basis that he's living in Henderson, Nevada. He's never done anything physically to harm her.
Physically, because coercive control is not a crime in the United States of America. Right. But because of Laura Richards, our own Laura Richards, it is a crime in the UK. And hopefully one day here, it will be a crime to coercively control someone the way John was coercively controlling
Deborah. Yeah, and it would have been a crime when her sister was alive, too. That would have been able to stop Billy
from killing her
before it got that far. Anywho, So at the end of episode 5, the escalation of all this is that he steals her car and tortures it. Why her car? Why that? What is the significance
of that? I think he was sending a message.
Was it the Tesla?
It was a Jaguar.
She had it parked,
I think it was a $65,000 car or something like that. It was parked outside her business. And he came one day. He was crouching in the bushes, looking around. This is all on surveillance footage. And he goes
Not
up to
Not a sophisticated it. Criminal. A petty criminal. That's what I would describe him as.
Well, he's also got a serious drug problem, so he's not thinking clearly. He's on a lot of painkillers.
And he's crouching in the bushes.
He's crouching in the bushes and peeking around, and then he's seen coming back in overalls, disappears with the car, and it's found a couple days later, torched about a block away, except he did a really incompetent job of torching it. He kept the windows and doors closed so that the fire had no oxygen to breathe, and the car survived with some damage to the interior. But the message was sent, and the security guard or the private eye that she'd hired to help her during this period said, he's starting to act out. Things are now at a new level. You need to start taking care of yourself in a real way. A lot of people urged her to get a gun. Because of what happened to her sister, she hated guns and she wouldn't get one.
Right.
Well, now, why didn't they arrest him for this car?
The Irvine Police Department was investigating it, and they caught him in some inconsistencies in his story. He actually admitted to coming and taking the car, but said he returned it unharmed, which is not the best thing to admit to if you live in another state. You've just put yourself at the scene, right? But they say they were going to arrest him any day now, although... The torching of the car was in June, and the climax of the story is in late August. So
took a while.
It took a while.
When we did threat assessments in the behavioral analysis unit, one of the pivotal things that turns something from a threat to a very real risk is action in the real world. In other words, threateners threaten, actors act, and if somebody threatens and never does anything in the real world, there isn't any physical, like travel to find something or to get or stalk somebody or and all those things, then probably the threat is on the low end. But when somebody actually does something physically in the real world and actually takes that step, they have crossed that line. And now their threats become a real risk to that victim. So I could see that this should have actually really lit up local law enforcement. They should have acted immediately if they were going to protect Deborah and her family. Apparently they didn't.
They say they were making the case as fast and as thoroughly as they could.
Probably just, emphasis on thoroughly then.
I don't even know what to say.
Okay.
Anyway, okay, so moving on. So it seems like, okay, there's an imminent threat. Something terrible is going to happen to Deborah, or at least something terrible is going to happen to Jacqueline, her daughter, who he absolutely hates with a passion and has said
and
over...
Why is that?
Huh?
Why does he hate her?
Because she doesn't take any shit from this guy.
No,
she
not at all.
She absolutely doesn't.
She was onto him from the jump.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Episode 6 is called Tara.
Tara is the other daughter.
Yes.
Tara is the daughter that Deborah, the mother, was not really concerned about getting hurt. She didn't even put her in the restraining order request because she thought John dislikes her least of all my kids.
Really? And is that because Tara had already separated herself, or she was just trying to be sort of
neutral? Tara was much less confrontational by nature than Jacqueline. Didn't like John, but didn't really get in his face in the way that Jacqueline did. And Tara was living...
For a long time, she was in Vegas, right? She wasn't, like, in his line of fire.
Yeah, she wasn't in the orbit so much. But by August of 2016, she was living alone in an apartment in Newport Beach called the Coronados. And working at a dog kennel. On the late afternoon of August 20th, John found her.
Okay, but let's set this up a little bit. What was the situation with Deborah at this point, between Deborah and John?
At this point, Deborah had cut him off.
Completely.
She'd completely cut him off. He was sending her texts, emails, trying to call. She wasn't responding.
She was totally undercover. She was hiding. She was jumping from hotel to hotel.
Wearing wigs, trying to be inconspicuous.
Completely avoiding.
So he's probably stalking her, trying to find her. Not able to find her, but he could find the daughter. He could find Jacqueline.
Right.
The more aggressive daughter.
And so on August 19th, late in the evening, Jacqueline, the daughter he especially hates, is coming home to her apartment where she's living with her mother. And she sees John. John is waiting outside her place in a darkened car, and she sees his face reflected in the light of his smartphone. And he seems startled, and she gives chase, and she loses him. And she fears that he's going after Tara.
Hmm.
And so that night, Jacqueline and a friend circle Tara's place over and over. She doesn't wake her up, but she checks her door to make sure she's okay, that nobody's broken in, and she hears the reassuring little tingle of the bells of the cat inside. And the next morning when Jacqueline wakes up, she calls Tara and says, John is in town. Watch out.
Mm.
Bring your knife with you.
Well, she was very, very astute. I mean, obviously, she was listening to her own instincts there. It's really amazing. But what's really pivotal here is one of the things John tried to do to intimidate other people. Part of his threats was always that his grandmother was part of a notorious mafia family, and he liked to think of himself as a mobster, and his father liked to think of himself as a mobster, and passed this on to his son John.
And he claimed to be a direct lineal descendant of Albert Anastasia,
right.
the Lord High Executioner from Murder, Inc. itself.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to establish this connection. His sisters, though, did send me some documents which show their grandmother has the name Anastasi, and sometimes it's Anastasio. So there may or may not be a link. I haven't been able to prove or disprove it.
But if John was telling the truth about that, that's the first time he was telling the truth about his history. So let's not give him the credit that he probably most likely does not deserve. But one of the things that he was proud of was the fact that in the mafia, if you wrong a mafia person, you don't just get back at the person who wronged you. You get back at them by attacking their family. That is absolutely part of the code of the mafia. You never mess with family unless somebody wrongs you.
So this is Christopher Dorner all over, actually.
Absolutely.
You remember the first two people that he killed?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Oh,
yeah.
So terrible.
Absolutely.
If people don't remember who that was, can you remind us?
It was the daughter of the lawyer that had represented Christopher Dorner and her husband. Actually, and the fiancé. I'm sorry.
Right.
They weren't married yet.
Yeah.
Monica Kwan was her name.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. It's really sad. And, of course, he takes people out. And in a way, that's very safe for him, right? He's at a distance. He's not at any threat. He kept threatening LAPD, right? But he never actually did any kind of direct attempt to attack LAPD. He was always dancing around the periphery. And he was killing people, unfortunately, that crossed his path. And it's terrible, the destruction that he brought upon the area around Los Angeles.
He thought that the way to inflict maximum pain on people he thought were his enemies was to go after the loved ones. And I think that's what was in John Meehan's mind in late August of 2016.
And what exactly did he do?
Well, Tara Newell is coming home from the dog kennel.
Where she worked,
and she's preoccupied with a country music concert that she's going to be going to that night at Irvine Meadows. Jason Aldean is in town, and she loves him, and she wants to go to the concert. So she's not thinking that John is in town, and she's not carrying her knife. It's not in a handy place. She's got mace, but she doesn't have that handy either. So she pulls up the ramp to her outdoor parking garage at the Coronados in Newport Beach. And she sees a guy that is standing behind his car near an open trunk. He's got a crowbar. Her dog, a miniature Australian Shepherd named Cash, begins barking, and she hushes him. She doesn't think it's anything serious.
She doesn't recognize John.
She doesn't recognize him. John has lost 50 or 60 pounds. He, at his biggest, he was he had the build of a football player or a bodybuilder. I mean, 6'2", 225 pounds maybe, big thick guy, probably pumped up on steroids. And he was down to about 163 pounds at this point. He was either sick and or seriously strung out on painkillers.
Yeah.
So she doesn't recognize him, but as she's crossing behind her car, he comes up to her and looks her in the eye and says, "Do you remember me?" And she doesn't go quietly. She kicks and screams and fights with everything she has in
her. But he grabs her and cuts her, right?
He grabs her and tries to yank her to the car where his trunk is open and where he has what the Newport Beach police call a kidnap kit set up. He's got zip ties. He's got camouflage duct tape. He's got his passport, so he may be trying to get out of the country.
Well, it sounds to me like they're being very generous when they say kidnap kit. It sounds like a kill kit to me. And especially if he has his passport, he's not going to abduct her and take her overseas. He's going to abduct her and kill her, and then he's going to go overseas. Mm.
He never left a note, so exactly what he had in mind isn't clear. There is some evidence that he was unhinged at this point, not thinking at all clearly because he had smashed out the lights of his car, and he'd done some inexplicable damage to the dashboard of the inside of his car as if in some kind of
rage.
Manic rage.
Mm-hmm.
So one theory was that he took out the lights of his car so he could move more quietly, unseen in the dark. But one of the cops I talked to said that wouldn't be such a smart idea because we'd pull him over for a broken light.
Yeah.
So he was not thinking clearly, and it's not really clear what he had in mind, but
he was clearly
he clearly had a violent intent,
right? And he was thinking clearly enough to actually go after the person who meant the most to his target.
And he stalked her for some time.
Yes.
She had no reason to believe he knew where she lived, so he'd been watching her. This had taken some time to put together,
right?
Yeah, and you mentioned that he actually called the dog kennel. We theorize that he was posing as a client who was going to bring his dog in so he could find out when she was leaving.
Right.
You know, how late are you going to be there to do, you know, to take, to
so
groom
she,
my dog?
So he could follow her home, find out where she lives, and then lay in wait there. I mean, this is a plan.
Yeah.
This is stalking. This is exactly the kind of thing Laura talks about all the time. He wasn't so incoherent that he was going after some random person. He was going after a target for a very specific reason. He wanted to hurt Deborah, and the best way to do that, inflict the maximum damage, would be to murder her own daughter.
Some of the details about John's past she learned right then. Some she would learn in the weeks that followed. Had she been in denial the whole 5 months she'd known him? How had she missed what seemed so clear to her kids?
Well, thank goodness, she fought within an inch of her life. Oh my gosh. And she's tiny, right? She's like...
She's 5'2", and even though he was much diminished in size, he was still 6'2". You know, he'd survived prison cells and jail cells, and he had the element of surprise, and he had a long, sharp knife that he'd taken out of a kitchenware set from the house in Nevada.
And I will tell you, knives are very personal weapons, and that tells me a lot, that he chose to use a knife rather than a gun, rather than a bat or the tire iron that he had in his hand. A knife is a very scary thing to human beings. Part of that It's a visceral reaction that humans have to that. Almost every person has cut their finger or cut themselves over the course of their lives. It's why the terrorists on 9/11 actually used blades, razor blades. They went low-tech on us. We had all these high-tech security measures, but those things, you can actually control people better with a knife than with a gun. Very few people have an experience of being shot, so they don't viscerally feel what it would be like. But everybody can recall back to getting sliced with a knife and cut, and just they can fear that happening to their vulnerable areas like their neck or their gut. They're really afraid of that, and so it's easy to control them that way. That's what he expected to happen. He got surprised.
Right, and it's something that Jim has told me many times, and I know he's said in previous podcasts, that if somebody is taking you, kick, scream, bite, claw the eye, do... ears,
don't get in the car.
Yeah, just do anything you can.
Never, ever, ever go somewhere else with somebody who's threatening you, because they will only take you to a place where they have more privacy, control, and bad ideas of what they want to do to you. Fight now. You won't have as much of an opportunity to fight later. And the other thing that I'll say right from the start before we even get into what happened is her sister called her and said, keep your knife with you, all right? The sister obviously felt really bad about what was going to happen. And apparently, Tara had mace but didn't have it available. I always carry this with me.
What is that?
So what he's holding up.
It's a tactical pen.
And Jim gave one to me. So,
it's a tactical pen, and it's actually manufactured to, if you get stuck in your car,
it's a
you
swag
need to
for
break.
Gifts of your show, for guys.
Yes, it is.
It should
you can use it to break out a window to escape from your car, but it's also a very good implement to be able to discourage other people from attacking you. You can jab them in the leg, in the arm if they're wrapping around you. If they're trying to kill you, jab it up in their throat, jab it in their eye. Do anything you have to do, but it's no good unless it's immediately accessible to you. So having it in your purse or having it somewhere else when you're vulnerable, like when you're getting into and out of your car, like when you're walking your dog at night, if you don't have it in your hand or immediately accessible, it's worthless. Why do you carry it around all day, all night in your purse when the time you need it, it's going to take more time to get it than it can be used effectively.
And it really is just the size of like a normal thick pen, kind of like a Sharpie. And it's a pen, but then on one end, it has a very sharp end.
A point.
And you can take it on, I hate to say, you can take it anywhere with you. You can take it on the airplane with you. Yeah, you can.
It's actually a pen.
Oh, it's a functioning pen.
Yeah, it's a functioning pen.
Yes. Yes, I take it like this on an airplane, yes.
Yeah, but it's a defensive...
Well, I keep it because...
And where do you aim?
Well, it depends on where the person is with respect to you. If somebody comes up and surprises you from behind, right, they put their arm around your neck, I would jab the hell out of that arm. They're going to let go. If I can't get them there, I'm going to jab them in the side or in the leg.
Enough time just to get away.
Right. If somebody's attacking me from the front, the very first thing I would do is put it up through their throat. Why would I want them to get close enough to me to hurt me? If somebody is attacking me, I'm on the ground, I would jab it through one of their eyes. I would do whatever it takes to get them away from me so that they're not a threat anymore. If they were attacking somebody I knew, I would use it in the same way. It's a very simple personal weapon, and it's very easy to conceal. I just keep it in my pocket like this, and then if somebody's coming at me, I just do that.
You know, I think sometimes women feel like they can't survive if they're being attacked, you know?
And this shows
us that you can. So, you can survive, and there's no reason to give up, and there's no reason to stop fighting. Because
right.
What does she do? You describe it in your story. She kicks him. How did you describe it?
She's on her back, and she's pedal kicking.
How did she get on her back?
They fell to the ground. Her dog played a role in this.
She has this little
Australian shepherd that came to her defense, and he starts biting John's ankles. That might have played a role. However it happened, they tumble down. She's on her back, and she's pedal kicking him, and he's coming down with this knife.
Ugh.
And He gets her a couple times. He gets her in the forearm, opens up a gash in her arm.
That's a defensive wound.
She's got one on her abdomen.
Wow.
So he was clearly trying to kill her.
And she was fighting for her life.
She was fighting for her life, and she had what a prosecutor told me was the gift of adrenaline. And there are a number of other interesting things that probably contributed to her survival because she works in a dog kennel. She happened to be wearing very thick-soled, thick-treaded rain boots, which is not something you see in Southern California on people in the middle of August. And she got him in just the right angle as he was coming down with the knife, and the knife flew out of his hand and landed by her right leg. And she reached out and she closed her fingers around the handle and began wailing on him.
Wow. And, you know, so she kicks it out of his hand. I mean, it could have gone 5 feet away, 2 feet out of her reach, and she would never have been able to use it. But fortunately, it fell in the right place, and she was able to pick it up.
And she did not hesitate.
No. Well, adrenaline, and she's fighting for her life. Why
and
would
she
hesitate?
And she didn't pick up the knife and go, okay, get away from me.
Right.
She was like, fuck no. If I'm, I'm going to survive this, and you're going to stop. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's an important lesson, too. There is no time to negotiate in that situation. It's unfortunate that people try to take advantage of other people this way. But if you ever get an opportunity, you have to take full advantage of it. How many movies have you been at where, you know, you're screaming at the screen at the end, no, run away, don't just hit him over the head and then turn around. Don't do that. Don't do that. Because if they get back up, it's over. And why put yourself in that situation? You're going to have to neutralize the threat. And unfortunately, nobody was around to help. Her dog did what her dog could do to help, but that was it. And so she had to rely on her own two hands and 2 feet. And fortunately, she kept going, didn't she?
She kept going, and the autopsy report showed that he had 13 cuts, one of which went through his eyeball into his brain.
Wow.
And that was eventually effective enough to
stop him. That was the fatal blow. He hung on for 4 days in kind of a vegetative state, and one of his sisters was brought in, and she finally pulled the plug.
Mm.
And one interesting thing about this is Tara felt guilty about having killed a person.
Of course she did. Never thinking
that she'd kill anybody.
Yeah.
But the sisters visited her soon after the attack that she survived and said, look, our brother was a bad, bad man. He frightened a lot of people.
Not to mention, he took advantage of, abused, made people feel horrible, stole their money, stole their affections.
That too.
Yeah. So.
And there was no funeral service. Only one person, according to Deborah, expressed any interest in going to his funeral, and that was somebody who knew him through basketball and who had the mistaken impression that he was a doctor. Mm. So the only person who thought, hey, I'd like to attend his funeral was deceived about him in a fundamental way. He was for all his glibness and charm and charisma, an extremely isolated, person.
But that is the life of a psychopath. I mean, they really don't form human bonds, and the only thing that they do feel emotionally about is things they own, things that they possess. I mean, they can be very, very aggressive if somebody harms something that they believe is theirs. So there's a connection to things, but there's no connection to other people. People are just seen as things to them.
Can I back up for 1 second? Going back to after Tara's, she subdues him, and then she takes her phone and she calls her mom, and you say that she says, "Mom, I killed your boyfriend." How did you?
I'm so sorry. I killed your husband.
Yeah, not your husband
tried to
attack
me.
I mean, that is such an my heart just broke for her.
You know, because you've dealt with hundreds of these cases through Laura, that the victims of coercive control most of the time don't understand that they are the victims of a crime, that they are being manipulated.
I don't know this phrase coercive control quite as well as you do. I'm sure your listeners all know it by heart by now.
Yes.
But when you're talking about coercive control, you're talking about psychological control of a nonviolent sort, like you must arrange your wardrobe this way.
Absolutely.
You must drive this sort of car.
It can be subtle and overt. It can be that overt, or it can be done in such subvertive ways.
I don't want you to have to worry about the laundry. I'll go pick it up. I don't want you to have to drive to the school or drive to work. In fact, I don't want you to have to work at all. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to take you everywhere. You don't need this car. It takes away the freedom, and it locks them down bit by bit, isolates them from other people. It creates a situation in which overtly it looks like, wow, he's such a doting husband. He's such a great guy. Look what he does for her. He cooks for her. He runs around, does all the errands for her. But inside, she's like, I'm not allowed to talk to anybody. I'm not allowed to make a phone call unless he approves it. I'm not allowed to eat what he doesn't cook for me. I'm not allowed to have friends outside of this.
It starts to turn into rules. It starts off as, oh, this seems like he's such a great Prince Charming. And then pretty soon it starts to shift into rules that she's breaking. There's a million examples.
It's interesting as you say all that stuff. I'm going through the checklist in my head of all of the ways that that he did this. He would go with her to doctor's appointments. He would drive with her to jobs.
He would
carry her purse. Let me do your banking for you. You don't need to worry about this. Let me take care of these checks.
And he gets to interpret everything in her life.
Yeah, and he set up security cameras, right, so that he could watch her and see what she was doing and everything. She turned that on him, but he did it for a purpose, and it's all part of that same course of control. It's an atmosphere that they build piece by piece by piece, and eventually builds a wall completely around that person, and they have all control.
And certainly the person in those walls, they don't see it for a really long time that we've heard of. But it speaks to how powerful he is, really, that even when he's unconscious, you know, he still has that pull that makes her come to him. You know, in the end.
Well, so it's sort of a function of how scary he was and the impression that he made on people, that even after he's basically brain dead, lying on his deathbed, some people, in particular Shad, Deborah's nephew, is thinking, oh, he's going to get out of this. He's going to find a way to get out of this.
Yeah.
He's gotten out of everything before. He manages to beat the rap again and again and again.
Yeah.
And so there's this feeling that he's some kind of horror movie villain, you know, who's going to jump out of his deathbed, grab a weapon, and come at you again, like something out of Halloween or Friday the 13th.
Right. Or Criminal Minds.
That's the impression he made on people.
Absolutely. Wow. So do you have any other questions for us about John and the family?
I mean, what could they have done after they knew for sure that this guy was a menace? How do you extricate yourself from that situation without further imperiling yourself or your family?
Well, I think there's a few things that they can do. I think the most important thing to start is, as soon as you get inklings that things like this are happening, is to document. Write it down. The dates, the times, the places, the lies, the frauds, the misinformation that you get, and keep a book on this, because this is the kind of information you want to put forward later. When it's going to a court case, when push comes to shove, having a documented history rather than, well, I think he was kind of doing things like this, that will help you. A timeline, basically, of what happens.
I was going to say, one thing they can do that has been very helpful is to download something called the Dash, which actually Laura created.
Right.
But it's very helpful because it's a checklist. And you can take it, you can give it to somebody and say, why don't you take this? It's like a questionnaire that says, are you being, basically all the course of
it's
control.
It's like the PCLR, but it's for determining whether you're in a coercive relationship.
And sometimes it really opens up somebody's eyes to, like, oh my God, you know, this is happening to me. And then you can take that to the police, even if nothing violent has happened, to at least get it on the record. Like, I've scored this on the Dash, and that can start the paper trail.
So once you've got the paper trail and you know the guy is a psychopath, how do you get away?
Well, this is something that is very difficult to do. You have to have a safe exit. You can't just say, I'm going away, because unfortunately, if people around you aren't protected, you'll see what happens to Tara happen. Unfortunately, they will strike out. And typically, it is when the coercively controlled person actually does make a move to leave that it can become a fatal event. And so it's a very dangerous time. And that's why there are women's shelters that are set up to really extricate a woman immediately and fully so that there is absolutely no strings left. They take their cell phones. They take all their identifying information away. They don't want them to have anything because they're going to make a mistake. They're going to slip up. They're going to do something, and that person is going to...
What about in Deborah's case where you've got a life to lead and a business to run?
Absolutely. It's very difficult. And so that's just why you need that those documents. You need to document the whole history so that when you do, I would have gone to a lawyer if I were in Deborah's case, and I would have documented everything that he did. And I would have taken out legal action, even though it's not, you know, I mean, obviously, this guy uses the legal system. He knows if I make a threat of suing this person for this reason or complain against that person in her job, you know, complain to the board of this or that, that it could be difficult for them. Well, he's going to keep doing that. He's going to keep trying that. So you should be doing the same thing. You should be getting ahead of him. Don't let him use the legal system on his own. If you file a countersuit, well, it seems like you're just attacking somebody because they are telling the truth about you. But if you start it and you say, these are all the things that he did, if you have a detailed list, a timeline history of everything that's gone on, it's a lot easier to prove your case than if you just start trying to recall at the last minute. So there's that. There's also people who are professionals from my line of work who do this for a living. They help protect people who are in that situation. And certainly, if you have the money, if you have money
to
protect...
That's the thing. They had the means, for sure,
yes,
to be able
there to... There are people who can come into your life and help harden you and the people around you so that they are protected. I mean, you know, from where you're living and the security system there and the links to first responders, as well as... the way you travel to work and how you get along while you're at work and putting yourself in position. You know, for example, look at how the Secret Service does it with the President of the United States. I mean, obviously he has unlimited resources, but they do advance teams any place he's going. They vet the threats that are around there. They set up very hardened perimeters. They have an escape plan. All those things can be mirrored in your life, and there are professionals out there, like my brother Tim, who actually does that, and people around him, like Mike Dowd and others, that do this professionally to help keep people safe. It's unfortunate, and if you have to have money to do that.
Yeah,
if not, you have to be responsible in your life and have what we call situational awareness, and that is whenever you are outside the very secure protections of your home or work, you have to have situational awareness. You have to be aware of who's around you. You don't walk down the street with headphones in, playing loud music, or jog that way where somebody can just blindside you because you're distracted in your own world. Those kinds of things make you more vulnerable. And there are a lot of really good books, and we'll put them up on the site, about how to protect yourself in situations. One of the best is The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. And Gavin teaches you to listen to your own instincts because he said, I believe the statistic is like 85% of the people who actually survived a violent attack actually got some premonition beforehand. The hair stood up on the back of their necks. They got a chill. Mm. Something was wrong in their stomach. They didn't know exactly what it was, but it was the precursor to an attack. And what it is your subconscious is listening to all your senses at all times. And it can't yell out into your ear and say, there's somebody stalking you from behind. But as you were walking to your car in the parking lot late at night because you're a nurse, what you didn't calculate, what you didn't actually consciously calculate was that you stepped on some glass. That was a very light type of glass because it was from the light bulb above, which had lit this parking space, which the guy broke because he wanted to have you in darkness so he could attack you. You didn't clock it. You didn't really register it, but your subconscious did. So it made the hair stand up on the back of your neck. So instead of just taking out your key and putting it in the car, you put it between your fingers and you turned around and you punch him in the face with the key because he wasn't expecting it. That's how you got away.
Or your pen.
Or your pen, if you have a tactical pen. So those things are things you can do. I would read The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker, and I will put up some other books as well and other resources on our website. And I
just want to add that it seems like Deborah's daughters did try to do things. Clearly, they took steps to protect themselves, but I don't know. It doesn't sound like they engaged like somebody professional from the domestic abuse world or that kind of a world, like the World of Paladin, Laura's organization, or the things that Jim is saying. And certainly, I don't want people to think that you have to be rich to be able to protect yourself either. You know, somebody of less means would have just gone to their local shelter and gotten help that way. You know, the help is out there, but you kind of have to go get it and be educated about what is happening. Listen to me. I sound like I know what I'm talking about.
You've
learned so much.
Yes, well, we all have. That this has been a great experience. So any last words about Dirty John? Was he Dirty John?
He was. That was the nickname that his friends gave him in law school.
His friends.
And I don't think he really had any friends in the way that you and I would think of them, but they were the people that he hung out with. And they saw that he was willing to do anything to anybody, pull any scam. And I think it was a term of affection as he saw it, because he thought it was a badge of his, you know, mischievousness.
Well,
right?
A badge of honor. It's why he collected all those things. And it's why he's not embarrassed by this at all. This, to him, is accomplishment. All the trail of destruction behind him. And it's terrible. So,
we didn't get into the fact that he was actually a practicing nurse anesthetist.
You know, I thought,
for some time.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that requires a certain level of skill and knowledge and discipline. He graduated nursing school, then he went into anesthesia school.
Yeah, courtesy of his wife
helped him along the way, but he was skilled at this, and it's a good living. And he would say, I put people to sleep for a living.
And I siphon off their drugs while I'm doing it.
And the danger of that is, you know, not only if you are less than fully alert as a nurse anesthetist, you can kill your patient, but your patient can wake up in excruciating pain, not getting the painkillers that they need.
Right. But isn't it possible not only that they were in pain when they woke up, but that some of them passed away? And, you know, he did jump from job to job to job, right? He wasn't a nurse and anesthesiologist or anesthetist.
Nurse anesthetist, yeah. Anesthesiologist would be the physician.
The doctor.
Yeah.
So he wasn't a nurse anesthetist in one place. He was in multiple places, right?
Yeah, that was sort of the job. He was a freelance nurse anesthetist.
I wonder why. I wonder why.
Oh, God.
Because it gave him the freedom to move from place to place to place, to steal drugs from multiple places at the same time, so he didn't have to steal all of it from one place. Come on. There's nothing he did that wasn't deliberate. I really think you should take a look at everything over the whole course that you learned about him, and I think you'll see that every single thing he did, including the very last thing he did in his life, was very deliberate. Unfortunately for him, and fortunately for Tara, she was able to get the better of him.
Well, in any case, I mean, not only was this a very entertaining series, I think it's a really important series for people to be thinking about and talking about and learning about these kind of predators. And oh, man.
Well, Chris, we want to thank you so much for coming on Real Crime
Profile.
It's a
lot of fun to come on and listen to you guys.
And
I appreciate your insights.
Thank you for doing Dirty John as a podcast.
I've been steeped in this for 6-7 months now, and I've learned a couple things from you that I haven't before.
Well, we learned some stuff from you, too. And we're hoping that this is a continuing drama. We would love to have you come back to talk about the next series that you're going to write, and we'd love to be part of that if we can.
Absolutely.
And when this gets turned into a television show, I know who should play you.
Oh boy. You want to tell me off the air?
Maybe.
No.
I okay, I don't even know if you know this. Adam Scott would be perfect. I don't think you know who that is. Or Jeff Goldblum, like a younger version of Jeff Goldblum.
Okay, I'll take that as a compliment. Yes, I don't know the first guy.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're hoping that you're going to cast it, right? Yeah,
please.
Okay.
And you know what? We should really thank Wondery and the wonderful Hernan Lopez for producing this shindig along with his team at Wondery. I mean, what a wonderful project for them to be involved with. And thank you so much for involving us.
Yeah, and thank you to our engineer, Terrell Parham, for being here and making us sound great.
He's bowing. All right.
And that's it for this episode of Real Crime Profile. Thank you for listening.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.